We finished Roman 1 last week, which was the United Kingdom under Solomon, chapters 1 through 11. So that brings us to Roman 2 on that outline that I gave you, which is the divided kingdom before Jehu. Date of the divided kingdom, as you notice there, is 931. The revolution of Jehu, where he wiped out the house of Ahab, is at 841. So it's approximately a 100-year period, 931 to 841, which we'll look at under this Roman 2. Capital A is the disruption, and 1 is background. You've read this section in 1 Kings, as well as in the Expositor's Bible Commentary. Some of this is touched on there, but let me just mention by way of background that that disruption is not something that happened without any precedence. In other words, there were factors involved, I think, that led to that disruption that had been around for some time. And if you go back early in Israel's history in the land of Canaan, you remember the agreement that Joshua made with the Gibeonites, who came to him representing themselves as from a foreign land. And that's in Joshua chapter 9. And Joshua concluded a treaty with them, which meant that the Israelites really could not carry out the command of the Lord to destroy these people, because they had sworn in the name of the Lord that they would not do that. But that meant that right there in the heart of Canaan, you had these Gibeonites and the others that were allied with them that were permitted to remain as a foreign element in the land. You read in Joshua 9:14, the men of Israel sampled their provisions but did not inquire of the Lord. Then Joshua made a treaty of peace with them to let them live. And the leaders of the assembly ratified it by oath. So when they discover that they're really neighbors, they weren't foreigners, then you read in verse 18 of chapter 9, the Israelites did not attack them because the leaders of the assembly had sworn an oath to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. Verse 19 says, "We have given them our oath by the Lord, the God of Israel. We cannot touch them now. This is what we will do. We will let them live so that wrath will not fall on us for breaking the oath we swore to them." Now, those cities which are mentioned there in verse 17 are Gibeon, Kephira, Beeroth, and Kiriath-Jearim, which form a line of cities which kind of gives you a dividing point between the north and the south in the middle of the land of Canaan. Sometimes it's referred to as the Gibeonite wedge between the north and the south. But that was an alien, closely knit group that resided in the center of the land that tended to divide the land into a north and south. So that's one factor that may have tended to lead towards a division between the north and the south. Another factor may be simply the fact that there were two major tribes as far as territory and population was concerned, and that was Judah to the south of Jerusalem and Ephraim to the north of Jerusalem. So again, you have a factor that could contribute towards dividing north and south. Major tribe in the north, Ephraim, major tribe in the south, Judah. And then also there were previous divisive tendencies that you come across in some of the narratives prior to this time. You remember at the beginning of David's reign, He ruled initially in Hebron, just over the tribe of Judah. He ruled there for 7 years, just over the tribe of Judah. That time, Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, was ruling over all the northern tribes. You find that in 2 Samuel 2. The first few verses. In the course of time, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up to one of the towns of Judah?" This is right after Saul's death. He asked, and the Lord said, "Go up." David asked, "Where shall I go?" "To Hebron," the Lord answered. David went up with his two wives, Ahinoam and Abigail, and he settled in Hebron. And you read in verse 4, "The men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah." You see, he's king over Judah only. In chapter 5 of 2 Samuel, you read in the first few verses, after Ishbosheth had been murdered, who in the meantime had been ruling over the northern tribes, you read in chapter 5, "All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, 'We're your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel. You will become their ruler.' When all the elders of Israel had come to David at Hebron, the king made a compact with them at Hebron before the Lord. They anointed David king over Israel. He was 30 years old when he became king. He reigned 40 years in Hebron. He reigned over Judah 7 years, 6 months. In Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel 33 years. But you see in verse 5 there, you have that clear distinction that David ruled over Judah 7 years and 6 months, 7.5 years over Judah alone before he was recognized as king by the northern tribes. So there too, you see, you have reflected a tendency toward division between the north and the south. Another factor, which really is prior to what we've just looked at as far as chronology is concerned. During the time of David's exile to when he was being pursued by Saul, and he fled for his life, and he found a place of refuge among the Philistines. And during that time, when he was in exile in Philistia, during the reign of Saul, he maintained close relationships with the leadership of Judah. You find that in 1 Samuel 30. Verse 26. You read, "When David arrived in Ziklag," which is a Philistine town, "he sent some of the plunder to the elders of Judah, who were his friends, saying, 'Here is a present for you from the plunder of the Lord's enemies.' He sent it to those who were in," and it lists a number of places, towns in Judah. So, you see, David had cultivated a close relationship with the leadership of Judah and with the towns of Judah during that time. And then when Saul was dead, it was natural that Judah immediately claimed him as king, but the northern tribes did not. Another possible factor I mentioned earlier in connection with our discussion of Solomon, in chapter 4 of 1 Kings, when you look at those districts that had to provide support for Solomon's court, remember I mentioned at that time that it doesn't seem like there's any reference to the area of Judah in those 12 districts, so that some feel that perhaps during Solomon's reign there was favoritism shown to Judah. And if that's the case, that can again tend to be divisive. But in any case, when you get, that was in 1 Kings 4, those 12 districts.
There was no mention of Judah, therefore.
There's no mention of Judah, either by name or in its description of area. It doesn't seem that any of the areas described coincide with the territory of Judah. So it's the conclusion that some have drawn, and that's just an inference, is that Judah was not required to provide this monthly support for the court. They were exempted, which would be a favoritism towards Judah, which was the tribe of David and Solomon. And that may have been the reason that they were favoring their own tribe. If that is the case, though, you can see how it would tend to be divisive. But those are some factors, perhaps, that are involved in background to what we find at this point in Israel's history, where you come to the disruption itself and the breaking of the kingdom into two parts. All right, number two on your sheet is Jeroboam rebels against Solomon and Solomon's death. 1 Kings 11:26 through 41. As you remember, Jeroboam, often termed Jeroboam, son of Nebat, he was an official of Solomon's court who was put in charge of the labor force of Ephraim and Manasseh. If you look at verse 28, you read, Jeroboam was a man of standing. This is 1 Kings 11:28. He was a man of standing, and when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the house of Joseph. Now, the house of Joseph would be Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim and Manasseh were the two sons of Joseph who became the heads of the two tribes and the tribal territories of Ephraim and Manasseh. So Jeroboam, son of Nebat, was in charge of the labor force of those two tribes. He himself was from the tribe of Ephraim. You see that in verse 26. He was one of Solomon's officials, an Ephraimite from Zereda. His mother was a widow named Zeruah. Of course, Ephraim is the northern tribe, the counterpart to the major tribe in the south. He apparently, even prior to Ahijah coming to him and telling him that, look, the Lord's going to take away the kingdom from David and give you a good part of it. Even prior to that, it seems like he had determined to instigate a revolt against Solomon. I say that on the basis of a phrase in verse 37 where you read, this is in the words of Ahijah. He says, as for you, I will take you and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will rule over all your heart desires. Sounds like Jeroboam already contemplated and wanted the kingdom. You will rule over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel. Now, as you recall, this man, an Ephraimite, in charge of this labor force, apparently already with a desire to rule, is confronted by Ahijah, a prophet, and told both in word and in symbol. And what I mean by that is Ahijah had this coat that he tore into 12 pieces, and he told Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself. And then he says that symbolism means the Lord says, I'm going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. That's verse 31. But for the sake of my servant David, in the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. So Jeroboam's encountered by Ahijah, who tells him both in word and symbol that the Lord is going to take 10 tribes from Solomon and give them to him. But as Ahijah goes further, he makes it clear that that's not to happen in Solomon's days. In verses 34 and 35, he says, I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David my servant, whom I chose and who observed my commands and statutes. I will take the kingdom from his son's hands and give you 10 tribes. I will give 1 tribe to his son so that David my servant may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem. So Ahijah tells Jeroboam he's going to get these 10 tribes, but he says that's not going to happen in Solomon's days. It's going to happen in the days of his son. But apparently Jeroboam did not want to wait for the Lord's timing and wait for Solomon's death. And apparently he attempted a revolt even prior to Solomon's death. Because you read, you see, in verse 26, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. And you read down in verse 40 that Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt, to Shishak, the king, and stayed there until Solomon's death. So, if you put verse 26, where it says Jeroboam rebelled, together with verse 40, where it says Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, it seems like Jeroboam tried to, even prematurely, grasp the northern tribes for himself, even before Solomon's death. That sort of gives you an ominous sign, you might say, about what kind of reign you might expect to come from Jeroboam when he does come to the throne in the north. It seems that he was not willing here, even initially, to submit to the word of the prophet who said this will not happen in Solomon's days. Tried to take things in his own hands. But it appears that his failure then to successfully take the kingdom before Solomon's death resulted in the necessity of his flight to Egypt, where he stayed until Solomon died. Now, the reason why God judged Solomon in this way, by taking 10 of these tribes from his line, from his descendants, the reason is given earlier in the chapter, which we looked at last week, verses 9 through 13. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart turned away from the Lord. And verse 11 says, the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. So you get the reason there. Also in verse 33 of the chapter, in the passage we're looking at tonight, you read, I will do this because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, god of the Moabites, Molech, god of the Ammonites, and have not walked in my ways, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my statutes and laws, as David Solomon's father did. So those are the reasons. They turned away from the covenant. They went after false gods. Okay, that's number two. Jeroboam rebels against Solomon. And then at the end of that chapter, verse 41, you read of Solomon's death. As for all the other events of Solomon's reign, all he did, wisdom he displayed, are they not written in the book of the Annals of Solomon? Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel 40 years. Then he rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David his father, and Rehoboam his son succeeded him as king. So that brings us to number three, Rehoboam's foolish attitude. And that's 1 Kings 12. The next chapter. We read there at the end of chapter 11 that Rehoboam succeeds Solomon as king. Seems to be a normal succession. However, there is the interesting statement in verse 1 of chapter 12 where it says, Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all the Israelites had gone there to make him king. That seems like that's a reference to the northern tribes. Remember, when David became king initially, he was king over Judah. He only later was accepted and acclaimed king by the northern tribes. And it seems like when this succession takes place here, that Rehoboam feels that it's necessary to go to Shechem and be ratified as king by the northern tribes. You read in the second verse that when Jeroboam, who had fled to Egypt, hears about this, he quickly returns from Egypt to be present. And in that meeting, you find the demand is placed on Rehoboam to lighten the yoke which Solomon had put on the people of Israel. You read in verse 4 that the assembly said, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." And Rehoboam asks for some time to consider that. He consults with some advisors that advised his father, Solomon, and they advised him to consent to that. But then he consulted with some younger advisors. You read in verse 10, the young men who had grown up with him replied, "Tell these people who have said to you, 'Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter.' Tell them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions.'" In other words, not only were the tasks to be intensified, but the punishments as well. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions. A scorpion is a leather strap filled with sharp protrusions of metal or stone or something like that that would cut. And the tasks are intensified. The punishments are intensified. And certainly these words betray a foolish attitude. Not only a foolish attitude, they're hardly the words of a true covenantal king. Someone who has a concern and compassion for the people over whom he has been placed as ruler. So the response of Israel is in verse 16. When all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, "What share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel, look after your own house, O David." So the Israelites say, "We're not going to accept you as king." Rehoboam is not ready to accept that response. So he sends out in verse 18 a man named Adoniram. You read, King Rehoboam sent Adoniram, who was in charge of forced labor. He had been in charge of that under Solomon, Rehoboam's father. But all Israel stoned him to death. King Rehoboam, however, managed to get into his chariot and escape to Jerusalem. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day, that is, to the day in which, presumably, the book was written, 2 Kings. In other words, the kingdom at this point was divided, and it remained divided for the rest of its history. So the prophecy of 1139 is fulfilled. 1139, Ahijah had said, speaking for the Lord, "I will humble." So the prophecy is fulfilled, and Judah remains separate from Israel for the rest of Israel's history until the time of the exile. Question?
Yeah, in the commentary, it spoke of the poetic section, verse 16,
mm-hmm.
and because of his poetic practice, it's been saying it was going on for a while, and he's already planning and going to the common one.
Well, it's possible. I think it's hard to say. I think it's somewhat speculative. There's another thing that may be a factor there. The dividing line between Hebrew poetry and Hebrew prose is very fluid. The primary thing that is usually pointed to as the characteristic of Hebrew poetry, which sets poetry apart from prose, is parallelisms. And you see, you have here, what share do we have in David? Then what part in Jesse's son? So you get two parallel lines. To your tents, O Israel, and then look after your house, O David. However, you see, so you have a double parallelism there. However, you find parallelisms like that sometimes in prose as well. What's more clearly prose? So how much weight here to put to this being, quote, poetry? Maybe it's somewhat of a question, too. Certainly has that parallel form. But that could be just a part of the expression, which, you know, a forcible way to put this, which was that kind of repetitive thing is characteristic of Semitic writing generally. All right, that was three. Rehoboam's foolish attitude. What's going to be? A was the disruption. B is the first three kings of Judah, which are Rehoboam, Abijah, and Asa. And one is Rehoboam then. 1 Kings 11:42. This is on your outline. 1 Kings 11:42 to 14:31. That's paralleled in 2 Chronicles 9:31 to 12:16. Now, I have two sub-points there, also in your outline. A is Rehoboam's attempt to reconquer Israel, 1 Kings 12, 21-24. And B is relations with Egypt. Let's look first at Rehoboam's attempt to reconquer Israel, 1 Kings 12, 21-24. At the end of that chapter, it's not all the way at the end, but beginning there in verse 21, you read that Rehoboam decides to raise an army to attempt to forcibly subdue the northern tribes, to restore unity to the kingdom. However, he's confronted by a prophet. The word of God comes to Shemaiah, who then comes to Rehoboam and tells him, don't do it. You read there in verse 24, this is what the Lord says, do not go up to fight against your brothers, the Israelites. Go home, every one of you, for this is my doing. So they obeyed the word of the Lord and went home again as the Lord had ordered. So on that matter, Rehoboam submits to the word of the prophet. He drops his plans and the division remains. B is relations with Egypt, verses 25 through 28. This skips forward to chapter 14, 1 Kings 14, 25 through 28. See, what happens here is the writer of Kings shifts at that point in chapter 12 to what's going on in the north with Jeroboam and his setting up for the golden calves and so forth. And he doesn't come back to Rehoboam until chapter 14, verse 21 and following. But you read there in verse 25, 1 Kings 14:25, in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem. And he plundered the temple and the royal palace. You read, he took everything, including all the gold shields Solomon had made. So Rehoboam made bronze shields to replace them. Now this reference is interesting because it's one of the incidents in the kingdom period that is corroborated with extra-biblical evidence. And in fact, we learn from Egyptian records that when Shishak attacked Jerusalem, that was really part of a larger campaign. It wasn't that he just came up out of Egypt and attacked Jerusalem. It's the only thing the biblical record tells us about. But a victory inscription of that campaign was found on the walls of a temple in Thebes. And in that inscription, Shishak lists numerous cities that he plundered. And this is interesting. They were cities not just in Judah, but also in the northern kingdom. And that's rather striking because you remember that Jeroboam, who now was king in the northern kingdom, when he had prematurely tried to revolt against Solomon and been unsuccessful, he fled to Egypt and had refuge with Shishak. But that didn't seem to make you think. You might think Jeroboam and Shishak would have been on good, friendly terms. But that didn't seem to make much difference at this point because Shishak undertakes this campaign up in the land of Canaan and attacks not only Jerusalem, but cities in the northern kingdom as well. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with these two volumes. These are the two standard volumes of ancient Near Eastern texts. This is the English translation of texts from Egypt, from Mesopotamia, from the Hittites, generally from the ancient Near East. The texts that have been translated and published up to this point, or at the point that this was put together. It's edited by Pritchard. This is a companion volume called Ancient Near Eastern Pictures Relating to the Old Testament. So that in many cases, the texts that are translated in this volume, you have a picture of them in this volume. The text of that victory inscription by Shishak is on page 263 in this Ancient Near Eastern text. And in Ancient Near Eastern Pictures, it's picture 349. I'll show you this and pass it around. It's, I think, interesting to see this. It's picture 349 on page 118. That's on the bottom here. You can see a picture there of Shishak. And then inscriptions all surrounding it. And it says, list of Palestinian and Syrian towns captured by Sheshonk, S-H-E-S-H-O-N-K, which is same as Shishak. Sheshonk and S-H-E-S-H-O-N-K. Sheshonk and Shishak are the same. The reason for the different spelling is there are different ideas of how Egyptian hieroglyphics are to be pronounced. Let me just pass that around and take a look at it. And then there's another piece of evidence that's been found, and that is a fragment of a monument that was found at Megiddo. Megiddo
on the right up about in here.
Which bears the name of Shishak. Fragment of a monument found at Megiddo that bears the name of Shishak, which most feel probably means that he had set up some sort of monument at Megiddo at the time of this campaign as sort of a victory monument. It had his name on it, and a piece of that with his name has been found. That's in ancient Near Eastern text, page 264. I don't have a picture of it, but... Oh, wait a minute. No, I don't. Now, so that's the attack of Shishak mentioned there in Kings. There is a fuller description of it and the reasons for it in 2 Chronicles 12, which is parallel passage. If you look at 2 Chronicles 12:5, you read there that Shemaiah, same prophet who had told Rehoboam not to go back and attack the north, in 2 Chronicles 12:5, he says, Prophet Shemaiah came to Rehoboam, the leaders of Judah, who had assembled in Jerusalem for fear of Shishak. He said to them, this is what the Lord says, you have abandoned me, therefore I now abandon you to Shishak. The leaders of Israel and the king humbled themselves and said, the Lord is just. When the Lord saw they humbled themselves, this word of the Lord came to Shemaiah, since they have humbled themselves, I will not destroy them, but will soon give them deliverance. My wrath will not be poured out on Jerusalem through Shishak. They will, however, become subject to him, so that they may learn the difference between serving me and serving the kings of other lands. When Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem, he carried off the treasures of the temple of the Lord, and so forth. So I think it's clear that the attack came because Rehoboam and Judah had turned away from the Lord. And when they repented and confessed that the Lord is just, the Lord ameliorated the situation so that even though they were plundered, they weren't utterly destroyed. Okay, that's Rehoboam, his attempt to reconquer Israel and his relations with Egypt. Secondly, Abijah. Or Abijam. His name appears in both forms. 1 Kings 14:31 to 15:8, parallel in 2 Chronicles 13:1 to 22. Abijah had a short reign, just 3 years. You read in 14:31 that Rehoboam rested with his fathers. It's a characteristic way of saying he died. And was buried with them in the city of David. His mother's name was Naamah. She was an Ammonite. And Abijah, his son, succeeded him as king. And then you read in 15:1. In the 18th year of the reign of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, Abijah became king of Judah. He reigned in Jerusalem 3 years. His mother's name was Maacah, daughter of Abishalom. He committed all the sins his father had done before him. His heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his forefather had been. Now, it appears that he was a complex personality with respect to this question of loyalty to the Lord. 1 Kings 15:3 there says that his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord, yet for David's sake the Lord spared him. But in 2 Chronicles 13:15 to 18, you get another side of the picture. 2 Chronicles 13. 15. And the men of Judah raised the battle cry. At the sound of their battle cry, God routed Jeroboam and all Israel before Abijah and Judah. The Israelites fled before Judah, and God delivered them into their hands. Abijah and his men inflicted heavy losses on them, so that there were 500,000 casualties among Israel's able men. The men of Israel were subdued on that occasion. The men of Judah were victorious because they relied on the Lord, the God of their fathers. Abijah pursued Jeroboam and took from him the towns of Bethel, Jeshanah, and Ephron, their surrounding villages. Jeroboam did not regain power during the time of Abijah. So in 2 Chronicles, we read that because Judah relied on the Lord, they were victorious over an attack by Jeroboam from the north. So it seems his life must have displayed a mixture of belief and unbelief. But it's certainly by God's mercy that Jerusalem was not destroyed, either by Shishak or by this attack from the north, because the indication is that their heart was not perfect, or Abijah's heart was not perfect toward the Lord as it should have been. As King says in verse 3, his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord as God. All right, Kings does not give a great deal of treatment of Abijah, and his reign was brief. Let's go on to Asa, which is the third ruler of Judah. 1 Kings 15, 8-24, and 2 Chronicles 14 through 16. Now, Asa was a major king. He ruled 41 years. He had a long reign. You see that in 1 Kings 15, 9. In the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Asa became king of Judah. And he reigned in Jerusalem 41 years. That's longer than either Saul, David, or Solomon. Length of Saul's reign is somewhat obscure. There's a textual corruption in the verse that describes the length of his reign. That's 1 Samuel 13, 1, I believe. Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel. NIV says 42 years, but that 40 is an insertion. In the text, there's a blank there. You see, the NIV text note says the Hebrew does not have 40. So it's somewhat obscure exactly how long Saul reigned. That 40?
Yes.
See if the note addresses that. No, it doesn't. Seems to me there's a reference in the book of Acts to the length of Saul's reign. I'm not sure I can find it. It might be in...
In
Acts?
That's probably
it then. What's that say? 1321?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, then the people asked for a king, and he gave them Saul, son of Kish, of the tribe of Benjamin, who ruled 40 years. Yeah. But you see, it says in 13:1, in the Hebrew text, Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 2 years. Now, Acts 13 says he reigned 40 years. If you read it the way the NIV has it, he didn't reign 40 years, he reigned 42 years. That could be a round number as compared to a more exact thing. But the thing is, the text in 1 Samuel 13:1 is something's happened to it. There's obviously a textual problem there. In any case, if he reigned 42 years, then what I just said isn't true. I said that Asa reigned longer than either Saul, David, or Solomon. He reigned 41 years. David reigned 40 years, and Solomon reigned 40 years. You read that of David in 1 Kings 2:10. David rested with his fathers, buried in the city of David. He had reigned 40 years over Israel. 7 years in Hebron, 33 in Jerusalem. And Solomon, 1 Kings 11:42. Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel 40 years. So Asa reigned 41 years. He's described as a good king whose heart was right. 1 Kings 15:11. However, there's a qualification. Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, 15:11, as his father David had done. He expelled the male shrine prostitutes from the land, got rid of the idols his fathers had made. He even deposed his grandmother Micah from her position as queen mother because she had made a repulsive Asherah pole. Asa cut that pole down, burned it in the Kidron Valley. But the qualifications in verse 14. Although he did not remove the high places, Asa's heart was fully committed to the Lord all his life. He brought into the temple of the Lord the silver and the gold, the articles he and his father had dedicated. That expression, that someone's heart was perfect toward the Lord, however he didn't remove the high places, or something similar to that, is something you find in a number of places in Kings. So I think we ought to look at what these high places were and what the implications of that are, which is a rather complex question. It's hard to know exactly how to understand that. Before we do that, let's take a 10-minute break. It's 5 of already.